From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Redwood City.
Belmont.
Midtown, San Jose.
19th Avenue.
Coming up, we'll conclude our series going inside the walls of death row at San Quentin State Prison.
The hardest part for anybody, whether you're on death row or here for 2 weeks, is if somebody out there in the street, one of your loved ones, is suffering a crisis, and you're stuck here and you can't do anything to help them.
Also, we'll hear a prisoner's perspective on Proposition 36.
I am no longer the self-centered, irresponsible, criminal-minded 25-year-old I was in 1994.
And we'll look back at the career of one of the Bay Area's most significant broadcast journalists.
We heard somebody down below yell, "What are you N-word people doing up there?"
The many stories of Belva Davis. That's coming up on Cross Currents. Tomorrow, voters will decide the future of this country through ballot measures and elected officials. But one decision in California will directly affect lives and deaths. Proposition 34 will determine whether or not California executes its most violent criminals. The state has the largest death row population in the U.S., with more than 700 men and women living in 4 condemned housing units. All 20 women sentenced to death are housed at the Central California Women's Facility south of Fresno. And all 707 men are housed in 3 separate death row units inside of San Quentin State Prison. KALW's Nancy Mullane has been telling the stories that take place behind those walls, gaining access where reporters haven't been for nearly a decade. Today, we'll conclude her series by visiting the top floor of North Block, considered to be Death Row's most exclusive quarters.
Okay, here we go.
I'm walking with Lieutenant Sam Robinson, the prison's public information officer, to an ominous cage at the end of a long walkway. The words "Condemned Row" are etched overhead. Robinson reaches for a phone at the side of the cage.
Drop the bucket. All right.
What does that mean?
Drop the elevator.
We're north, going in an elevator?
Yeah, north segregation is actually 6 stories up. It's on top of this 5-story facility that's called North Block. And it's an isolated housing unit that was designed many, many years ago to house our death row population. There were 68 cells originally identified here at San Quentin to house death row.
The structure was built in 1934, Robinson says, to house all of the state's inmates sentenced to death. But today, the vast majority live in San Quentin's East Block, and the most violent are housed in the Maximum Security Adjustment Center, just a few hundred feet away. An officer opens a door on the other side of the ominous cage, unlocks it, and stands to the side.
How are you doing, Officer Aguilar?
Good, how are you? Good. I see that. Welcome to North Central.
Thank you.
Now, opposite the entrance is North Seg. That door there leads directly, is the pathway directly into the gas chamber.
Just inside the door, an elevator stands open. It goes to only 2 floors, 1 and 6. We get inside and take a slow ride up. When we reach the top, we step out to a hallway. On the right, doors lead to offices. On the left, a series of locked gates lead to 1 floor with just 68 cells. On this side of the gates, officers move around easily, alert. On the other side of the locked gates, inmates move just as easily among themselves out in the corridor.
So this is death row.
This is death row. The inmates who live in this facility are in a much different environment than what we just witnessed over in the adjustment center.
They're walking around.
And that they're walking pretty freely. It's in a contained environment. Anytime they're in direct contact with staff or anyone outside of the containment of death row, they are in handcuffs and they're escorted by an officer. But unlike the adjustment center, when they're in the adjustment center, no one walks a tier freely.
No.
Here in North Seg, they walk the tier and they can essentially, instead of yelling out the tier or down this
to their
buddies, they can actually get here and talk to each other. Exactly.
So how long are they out of their cells like that?
I believe they released them out of their cells at about 7 o'clock in the morning. And essentially they hang out until about 1:30 in the afternoon.
I ask if I can take a picture of the ring of keys.
Sorry. They're so big. They're kind of impressive.
We'd have to rekey the whole facility.
I hadn't thought of that.
one of the keys on the ring opens the double-gated sally port that blocks the entrance to the corridor of cells.
We actually have gun coverage here in North Side, and so the officers on the opposite side of the inmates have a pair of .38 firearms that they utilize to just maintain security up here on the tier. And they actually patrol the tier back and forth all the time that the inmates are out.
Wait, but so when we came in, we came up there, then we came in here as a sally port.
This is a sally port.
Then if you want to go in there, that's a sally port.
Exactly.
And then there's the cell.
And there's another sally port.
Well, why is that one not have a sally port outside of that, these two?
This is actually what we utilize during the death watch as the death watch cells.
These two
right here are the death watch cells.
But there's people in there.
There's people in there now because we don't have a death watch. But if we were to have a death watch, these guys would be moved out of their normal cells. They would be housed elsewhere. And the guy who's on the death watch would be placed in one of these cells.
But that's kind of awful to put them in the death watch cells.
Well, you got to utilize the space as efficiently as you possibly can.
Looks ready?
Yeah.
I'll need to see your ID card.
Oh, yeah.
An officer says he's ready. Robinson follows him through a door and up a flight of stone steps.
We're going up some stairs from the cells to the yard.
To the yard for North Segregation, for the Northern North Segregation Alley.
At the top of the steps, the door opens out to the roof and a look west to Mount Tamalpais.
Wow, what a view. Why do you have to put the metal on the outside?
Security purposes.
That'd be so nice if they could see.
Well, I really don't think they're here to enjoy the view.
That's true.
We follow an officer toward a large fenced area. The sides are covered in long sheets of galvanized steel, making it impossible to see the inside. We turn the far corner past two officers holding rifles. A few feet away, some two dozen, mostly middle-aged and older inmates, dressed in white shorts and T-shirts, are standing around, talking. Over by a basketball hoop, a few men are playing a game.
Essentially, these guys are the most compliant condemned inmates that we have here at this facility. So they get tier time. They have a yard that's a little more accommodating than definitely the yard you saw over in the adjustment center and may have been in than what we'll probably see in East Block also.
Hey, guys. How you guys doing?
Hello.
A few of the men walk over. They're curious and want to know who I am and why I'm looking into their recreation yard. After identifying myself, I ask if anyone would like to tell me about North Seg. Curtis Irvin, a man wearing wire-rimmed glasses, walks over. He was convicted in 1991 for a murder for hire.
This particular program is not a true reflection of the entire death row, because this is, quote unquote, an honor program.
What's the honor part of it?
Well, there are more privileges. There are more privileges than, you know, than East Block death row. So there's just more movement.
How do you get on North Block death row?
Just waiting list. No write-ups.
An officer signals it's time for the men to return to the sixth floor and the cells below the roof. Inmates playing basketball put on their shirts. Others grab a book or towel and walk down a long caged path to the far end of the roof and through a door to a set of stairs. Robinson and I follow them back down the stairs to the cell block, where the inmates are now walking around together outside their cells. They are taking showers and making calls on the wall phones. An officer yells out that it's time for all the inmates to return to their cells for lockup. Without hesitating, all of the men turn and go. After all the cell doors have been locked, Robinson walks with me down the tier so I can talk to the inmates about their lives on North Seg.
There you go, light on. Is that when they ask me to?
Hello?
I stop at the cell of Richard Farley.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
He was convicted in 1991 of 7 counts of murder and sentenced to death by a Superior Court judge.
So, would you
standing inside his cell, up close to the door, he tells me he is diabetic. He says he's worried that voters may pass the California initiative converting all death sentences to life in prison without the possibility of parole. If that happens, he's concerned the medical care he'll receive out in the prison's general population won't be as good as what he's had on death row.
I'm concerned that if I lose my feet, I don't care to live anymore. That's my concern.
And you're diabetic?
I am diabetic. I've already lost a toe. at some point, either my kidneys are going to fail, or I'm going to lose my feet, or I'm going to lose my eyesight. And I don't particularly care to live on Main Line or in the medical facility or anything else under those conditions. So I don't really care. I mean, I'm fine up here. The only advantage if I go to Main Line is I might be able to access computers. I can go to the library. I can have a better facility for exercise. But outside of that, you know, there's not a lot there.
But you're not living with a death penalty over your head.
But I don't care.
Farley says he's been living on North Segregation since 1992 and in the same cell since 1993. I ask him what it's like to live up here on this exclusive death row.
I get my laundry done. I have clothes to wear. I get my meals. I don't have to do my dishes. I mean, I get reasonable medical care, not the best care in the world, but it's much better than it used to be. I get my insulin for free. It doesn't cost me anything. In return for that, I give up access to computers. I give up iPhones. I give up, you know, it would be a lot better if we had a job. Like, I'm a programmer. I could program computers. I could do something constructive, but they don't let you do that.
How, so it's been 20 years since you've seen a computer.
20 years since I've seen a computer outside of...
Can you imagine what the computers are like now?
I can imagine.
I move on and meet Douglas Mickey. In 1980, he was convicted of 2 first-degree murders and sentenced to death. He's been living on North Seg since 1983. Mickey's covered his light with colored paper to reduce the glare. He says he sleeps on the floor and uses his bed for a desk. And like the country boy he was, he finds ways to adapt to his surroundings.
I've been a hunt fishing guide up Alaska, and I really love the outdoors, but I could survive in here. I found, you know, I could stay productive.
You don't have any trees, though.
I got one right here. Bonsai.
He reaches down and lifts a small 6-inch macrame bonsai tree and holds it up to the light. Mickey says prison is prison, whether the sentence is death or life without the possibility of parole.
The hardest part for anybody, whether you're on death row or here for 2 weeks, is if somebody out there on the street, one of your loved ones, is suffering a crisis and you're stuck here and you can't do anything to help them. That's the hardest part of prison, period.
Currently, there's a moratorium on executions in the state, so there are no executions scheduled. But Mickey says over the years, he's faced 21 different death dates.
Well, what we go through now is people that we've known for 20, 25 years or more, who we get to know their families and their friends. Mm. And like Manny Babbitt was over at the Battle of Quezon, you know, and I've sat in his cell and gone through his album. He received a head wound over there. Received the Bronze Star for it, and then I see them strap them down and execute them. You know, it's like losing a family member. People that you spend that much time with, you get to know them as human beings.
Before leaving, I stop by the last cell at the end of the tier. Curtis Irvin is playing his guitar, the sounds filling North Seg. In 2000, the California Supreme Court upheld his death penalty. Irvin and his attorney are litigating the case in the U.S. District Court, claiming his innocence. If his appeals are refused and Proposition 34 does not pass, Irvin will only play his music on death row until he is executed. Inside San Quentin State Prison, for Cross Currents, I'm Nancy Mullane.
You can hear all of the stories in Nancy's series exploring the highest security prisons in California anytime at kalw.org. Listening to Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan. On tomorrow's ballot, among other measures, is Proposition 36, It would amend the three strikes law so that an offender would only receive a life sentence if the third strike was serious or violent. If passed, Proposition 36 would affect about 3,000 prisoners who could have a judge reconsider their sentence. From San Quentin, inmate Crisfino Kenyatta Leal sent us this commentary about the three strikes law. Kenyatta Leal is currently serving a life sentence for a nonviolent third strike. He was caught in possession of a firearm.
Prop 36 would not only reserve life sentences for violent and serious felonies, it would also allow those serving life sentences for nonviolent, non-serious felonies to apply for resentencing, provided they have already served twice the normal sentence for their current crime. In order to be approved for resentencing, each person would have to demonstrate to a judge that they are not a current danger to society. Although some of us have spent our time in prison waiting for the law to change, many of us have been working on ourselves to become taxpayers instead of tax consumers upon release. Take me, for example. I've utilized my time in prison as an opportunity to seek out help and learn how to develop insight into who I was, why I committed the crimes that I have committed, as well as understand the impact that those crimes have had on my victims, their families, and their community. Because of the help I've received and the effort I put forth, I am no longer the self-centered, irresponsible, criminal-minded 25-year-old I was in 1994. Today, I am a focused, compassionate man that truly cares about the lives of others. In 2011, I earned my Associate Arts degree from Patton University at San Quentin, and through programs like The Last Mile, Breaking Barriers, Project Reach, Center Force, the San Quentin Trust, and No More Tears, I've also been blessed with the opportunity to contribute to the very community that has given me so much. As a result of all these opportunities and my dedication to learning the most from each of these experiences, I now have several real job offers, a relapse prevention plan, transitional housing, a violence prevention plan, and a full support system to assist me at being successful when I'm released. July 9th, 2012 marked my 18th year of incarceration as a nonviolent, non-serious third striker.
Crisfino Kenyatta Leal's commentary comes to us from San Quentin Prison Radio, which is produced by Troy Williams, Nigel Poor, Sonia Shaw, and Jun Hamamoto. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. The 2012 election marks the final significant broadcast for Bay Area trailblazing journalist Belva Davis. She's come very far.
When I started applying for jobs on television, I had never seen a black woman television reporter. In fact, there were so few black people on television, there were so few women reporters back then, that it's hard to visualize the world today without the diversity that we enjoy. Back then, when we saw a person of color on TV, someone in the family would yell out, "Hurry, hurry, there's a colored person on TV. Hurry before you miss him."
Well, times have changed, and Belva Davis is now among the most established and well-respected broadcasters in the nation. She's hosted KQED's This Week in Northern California for 19 years, and she'll lead the station's local and national election coverage and then retire this Friday. During her remarkable career, Davis covered the UC Berkeley Free Speech Movement, the birth of the Black Panthers, and the assassinations of San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk. She's a true witness to history, as we're going to hear today. One of the first and most important stories that Belva Davis covered happened back in 1964, when the Republican Party held its convention in San Francisco. Barry Goldwater was running for president.
The man who came to San Francisco expecting to win the Republican nomination in a walk appears heading in that direction as the GOP convention opens. Senator Barry Goldwater is claiming more delegates than he needs to win on the first ballot.
President Johnson had recently signed the Civil Rights Act, and the Ku Klux Klan was demonstrating publicly in front of City Hall. Belva Davis was a young black woman working as a journalist, but she was new to the job, and it was her task to help cover the GOP convention. This is her story.
It was a convention where people of color knew from the onset that they weren't welcome. There were maybe 9 or 10 leading black men in the Bay Area that were activists within the Republican Party on the Central Committee, those kinds of things. So when my news director, Lewis Freeman, and I tried to get credentials and bring me along as his assistant. I was not a news reporter. I was just learning the game. He was denied press credentials. So one of these gentlemen got us 2 passes to sit in the rafters way above the convention hall. We went over, got into the darkest corner that we could, took out of our equipment, and started to report this story as best we could. It was a mean-spirited crowd up there in the galleries where we were. And we did all right the first day because they were behaving for the cameras. But then there was a speech by former President Eisenhower that was like lighting a match, in which he talked, the words he said could have been interpreted as being racist. And after that, all hell broke loose. Reporters were being, really big name reporters were being arrested. Really, one of the leading reporters was arrested on that night. So we watched all this from high. And finally, we heard somebody down below yell, "What are you N-word people doing up there?" And he screamed it in sort of a chant. And the next thing we knew, people down below us were standing looking up at us. My news director, Lewis Freeman, tried to be as calm and collected because he's a gentleman above all else, and decorum to him was everything. He simply said to me, "I think we've had enough for tonight. I think we maybe should prepare to go." Well, by now there's a mob of people screaming all kinds of things. Up there, isolated where we were in semi-darkness, we felt threatened. We started down the stairs, and garbage started being thrown at us. I didn't really get nervous until I could feel a bottle whiz by my head. It crashed against the concrete, and my knees started to shake as we were walking down the ramp to get out of the Cow Palace. And Lewis said to me, "If you cry, I will break your leg." Just like that. And I looked at him. I was shocked. Straightened my back, and we both kept eyes straight ahead. And got down to the bottom. And then we looked at each other because we saw uniformed officers. But coming from the South, we knew that was no safe passage. And we knew we still had the outside to the parking lot to go. We were both terrified. We were at a political convention for, one of the two organizations pledged to protect the rights of American citizens and feeling that our lives were in danger. But that's the way it was that year. It was a year when the Ku Klux Klan came out, demonstrated in front of our city hall, when they felt licensed to be as obnoxious about racial issues as possible. It was an experience that made me sure that I wanted to go into the news business because they were the only ones that seemed to be able to shine light on these people. And I wanted to do that.
That's Belva Davis talking about her memoir, Never in My Wildest Dreams, A Black Woman's Life in Journalism. She covered everything from the Republican National Convention in 1964 to the rise of the Black Panther Party. Here she remembers Huey Newton, co-founder of the Black Panther Party.
They remember him for the drugs and for the guns, but he was really, I guess you could call him an intellect. I mean, he loved to learn just so he would know it. And I really was convinced of that by the time he had already, solved most of his legal problems and was living in Oakland and having time to do lots of reading and research. And he used to convince a cousin of mine who lived in his building to invite me over because he wanted to talk. And I thought he wanted to talk about the day's events. He wanted to talk about, great scholars and thinkers, things that I knew nothing about. I'm not a college graduate. Was so far ahead, but he needed an audience. He needed to let someone know what he knew. So here was a guy who had a brilliant mind, somehow got off on a track, which, of course, anytime you're involved with drugs, that's where it's going, and got confused about actions and goals. Took a lot of actions that had never been taken. Had a streak that and a hot temper that got him in trouble. But on the whole, had a mind that was very, very sharp.
And you interviewed Malcolm X, right?
I ended up being his interpreter. He was at this sort of weird period when he wasn't talking to white people, or at least so his escort said. And my editor was white, and I was the black person in the office of a black newspaper. He never expected to see a white man in that place, so he refused to talk to him. So he would say something, and I would repeat his words. The editor would say something, and I would repeat his words. And we kept up this little game. It was one of the most unique things I've ever done in my life because I knew they both could hear what was going on and they could make judgments about whether I was interpreting correctly.
That's bizarre.
Yes, it was. But I think it was probably the fun of the day for him.
That's longtime Bay Area broadcast journalist Belva Davis. This week, she hosts KQED-TV's local and national election coverage, and on Friday, she'll retire from the airwaves. You can share your thoughts on her career at our Facebook page. We're KALW News. And that's it for today's Cross Currents. The team includes Isabel Angel, Hana Baba, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, RTN's Kunahoffs, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Lisa Ratner, Seth Samuel, Eva Sonsan, Judy Silber, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. What's that you're hearing? It's music from members of the San Francisco Rock Project, who are all between 7 to 18 years old. They'll be playing tomorrow night at San Francisco's Yerba Buena Center for the Arts Election Night Party. The event starts at 6 p.m., and it's free. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.